from News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
As Jesse Unruh, Speaker of the California Assembly in the 1960s, once said, quote, money is the mother's milk of politics, unquote. Raising and spending money in politics became considerably easier under the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling that gave corporations and unions unfettered access to the political process. The Supreme Court's decision gave rise to increased involvement by nonprofit advocacy organizations, political action committees, and super PACs in the political process. The result? Over $1 billion raised by each presidential candidate, and over $300 million spent on congressional races, a near fourfold increase from 2008. And in California, almost $375 million was spent on just the state propositions alone. Is this merely the exercise of free speech, or are politics becoming hijacked by special interests? We'll ask. Kevin Yamamura, political reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Ann Ravel, chair of the California Fair Political Praxis Commission. John Myers, political editor for News 10 in Sacramento. And Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee.
We'll also talk to Mike Belines, former Assembly Minority Leader, Juana Rambula, formerly of the Fresno School Board, the Fresno Board of Supervisors, and a member of the State Assembly, and John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee.
Money in politics, the costs of free speech.
From Fresno, the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. $6 billion was spent on political elections in the U.S. in 2012. How much of that was spent in California? Our first guest is Kevin Yamamura, political reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the money spent in legislative races and propositions in California. How much was spent this year, and how did it compare to previous years?
We think it's close to half $1 billion.
That's an amazing amount.
Yeah, it is, really. When you start using the B word, it is a lot. I mean, so initiatives alone, we're talking close to $400 million of that. And we saw a lot of very wealthy individuals participating this time. You also had some very expensive legislative races that took up airtime. And, you know, there's a high demand for that airtime, driving up costs. So
that really led to it. But that's over $500 million in California alone.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a crazy amount. You know, some people were talking about, you know, the influence of secret groups and wealthy donors on the election in particular. I mean, go through the propositions, and about half the proposition, it seems, were sponsored primarily by one wealthy donor.
In California, it's a big state with a lot of big media markets, and very expensive to be successful with ballot initiatives to get your message across. And particularly when there's so many initiatives this time, we had a lot of wealthy individuals participating. You mentioned, there are two from one family alone, Molly Munger, her brother Charles Munger Jr.
They apparently outspent the California Teachers Association 2-1.
That's hard to do.
That's amazing.
You had Mercury Insurance chairman participating on Prop 33. You had Tom Steyer, who had a clean energy and corporate tax initiative. So, yeah, I mean, and these guys are all very wealthy individuals.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that people talked a lot about was this influx of cash at the last minute, this $11 million that was used unsuccessfully to defeat Prop 30, the governor's tax for education, and support Prop 32, the effort to curtail union fundraising through employee contributions. What happened there?
That came in the last month of the campaign. We saw... I remember when the donation hit. It was during one of the presidential debate nights. We saw it come across $11 million from this group with this name that was Americans for Responsible Leadership. You couldn't discern anything from that name. Based in Phoenix, nobody'd ever heard of it. We tried to track down where they were from, what they were about. Couldn't find that out, really, other than that they had ties to conservatives in Arizona. And the FPPC ultimately jumped on it.
The FPPC is?
The state's campaign finance watchdog.
Okay.
And so they jumped on the case after they got a complaint from a common cause, a good government group. So they demanded through a lawsuit, they demanded documents from this organization, Americans for Responsible Leadership. They fought in the courts. Courts sided with them. At first, the trial court said, you're right, FPPC, but... this group does not have to turn over the documents immediately before the election. So then they had to fight at the next level and the next level. Finally, the California Supreme Court on the final weekend before the election said, hand over the documents.
Was this kind of like a rope-a-dope? I mean, just stalling game?
So that's what, you know, a lot of people think it was a rope-a-dope, and it ultimately turned out, you know, a day before the election, we find out that they have ties to two other groups with connections in D.C., and with ties to some big national conservative donors.
So the name the Koch brothers was thrown around, but do we really know whether or not?
We haven't seen the smoking gun or any document that says Koch brothers. They've denied it, kind of in a murky way. They've denied it, although they didn't fully deny their participation. So it's...
But part of these organizations, part of the attraction, I think, to donors is that their names are not released. Isn't that the case? Isn't that their argument, that they are, that confidentiality should trump disclosure?
That is their argument. I mean, it's nonprofits. This is not just a California issue, but one that is taking shape across the country in the wake of a few Supreme Court decisions, most notably Citizens United. The states are actually becoming the ones leading the way in terms of trying to fight this confidentiality and trying to force disclosure. We'll see. This is an issue that's going to play out both in the Capitol through new legislation and also in the courts.
So what's going to happen specifically with this case? Do they just drop it because the election's over or what?
The FPPC says they're looking for more information from the two other groups that were behind the donation. They've called it money laundering. They say they're going to keep fighting. I think what we're going to see is some more legislation in this new session to force disclosure. You'll probably see this end up in court, and maybe it goes to the highest court.
I guess we'll see. Well, thank you very much for being here. We're now joined by Ann Ravel, chair of the California Fair Political Praxis Commission. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thank you very much.
First, can you briefly describe what the FPPC does?
Yes. The FPPC is the state independent agency in charge of disclosure of political campaigns, contributions, expenditures, and also ethics of public officials. And we also oversee lobbying, and we have, of course, an enforcement function.
Well, there was a very big case recently in this last election about an $11 million last-minute donation, and you took some action based on that donation. Why did you think some action was necessary?
Well, first and foremost, there was a complaint filed with regard to that expenditure. But when we looked into it, which we always do when there's a complaint, we discovered that not only was the $11 million the biggest campaign contribution made that was anonymous in California history, but the group that made the contribution was from Arizona, had never made a contribution or any kind of activity in a political campaign in California before.
Don't they have to disclose who the donors are in California?
Yes. Our law with regard to disclosure is much more stringent than most laws throughout the country. And they do have to disclose who the donors are. They disclosed a group. It was the Americans for Responsible Leadership.
Sounds
as
like a
the
reasonable
donor,
group.
It does sound reasonable, but we did not know who was behind the contribution. And so when we asked them, they refused to give us information so that we could find out whether it was consistent with our law.
I don't want to get too wonkish here, but there's different kinds of organizations that give money. There's super PACs. There's these things called 501c4s. I think this was a 501c4, which is referred to as a social welfare organization, which is not established with the sole purpose for politics. So therefore, they don't have to disclose their donors under the federal law.
Under
correct?
The federal law, they don't. Under California law, they do if their donors knew or had reason to know that the money was going to a political activity in California. And our opinion was $11 million 2 weeks before the election. It gives rise to a question that we wanted them to answer.
So at the end of the day, you ended up chasing them around the country, basically, from Arizona to Virginia, et cetera. But did you ever find out who the actual donors were?
Well, we did not find out any names of actual people. But what we did find out was that Americans for Responsible Leadership was in fact a shell organization.
I think you referred to it as money laundering.
It is. Under our law, it's money laundering, because in California, if you give a campaign contribution, you must give that contribution in your name. And the Arizona for Responsible Leadership was actually not giving a campaign contribution. They were just a pass-through organization or a shell for two other 501c4s.
Well, what would you say to those who say, in the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because they weren't disclosed anyway, so they basically did rope-a-dope until after the election, so right. All of this attempt to get the name, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it didn't matter because the name was never disclosed prior to the election.
Unfortunately, we didn't find out the names of the human donors, but I think the fact that they spent so much effort trying to avoid giving the names to the California voters was significant. And the California voters have a right to know. Our law requires that they know who's giving money in California. And the fact that they didn't actually find out, but saw these machinations to try to prevent it to be found out, I think was significant for the voters.
So where are we going now? Is this going to be dropped, or is there something going to happen?
The FPPC is now conducting a formal investigation, not only into the Arizona for Responsible, or Americans for Responsible Leadership group, but also the PAC that received the money, and the other two 501c4s, and anybody else that we might find in the course of the investigation that contributed but didn't disclose.
We're talking with Ann Ravel, chair of the California Fair Political Practices Commission. You know, the right to know versus the right to privacy is a key tension that emerges when the issue of politics and money is raised. So what about the argument that donations should be allowed to be kept secret because of free speech and the need for protection from retaliation, they're more important than transparency?
Well, the public clearly needs to know the information in order to make assessments about how to vote. The courts have been explicit that it is constitutional to require this kind of disclosure that we've asked for. The court in Citizens United said that one of the protections of unlimited independent expenditure money is disclosure.
They actually encouraged disclosure.
They absolutely did encourage disclosure, and a number of other courts have done the same. Obviously, the tension between the two exists, and it's important that disclosure not be so broad that it impairs people's privacy rights.
Okay, well, what about ensuring transparency against the idea of the last minute flood of money, like occurred in the $11 million right. donation case? I mean, how do you make sure there's transparency at the last minute like that?
It's a challenge to do so. It is a challenge. And under our present law, we saw that it's very difficult and it's easy for these organizations to try to hide the information. So what we're seeking and we're hoping to accomplish is some legislation in the state legislature to enhance the ability to increase disclosure.
But isn't that a favorite campaign tactic, to dump money into a campaign at the last minute?
It is, and hopefully the FPPC will get stronger enforcement abilities before an election, because the election is crucial. People have to know.
Well, what about new forms of political communication, like the use of social media bloggers who are really secretly getting paid by a campaign?
Right.
How do you get disclosure there, mm-hmm. transparency there?
And that's a very important initiative that we at the FPPC have been pursuing. We're trying to be fair and not impair the rights of people to openly blog and use the internet. On the other hand, if people are being paid for political statements, they should have to disclose, much in the same way that any other political actors have to disclose.
You know, we were talking about the 501c4 organizations. Those are the social welfare organizations that are not primarily organized for politics under the IRS code. But some of these are spending a lot of their time and money in politics, actually. Is the IRS doing anything to against those organizations that are violating the rules?
The IRS has apparently sent some letters to a number of 501c4s asking them to justify that they are, in fact, social welfare organizations. But so far, there's no evidence that the IRS has taken any action against these organizations.
Are you hopeful that it may happen?
It's very important that it happen.
I guess well, you don't control that. That's the federal government.
No.
But I guess we'll see. But one thing you can influence is the California legislature.
Right.
Is there anything going on with the California legislature to increase transparency or to make sure that, you know, what you refer to as money laundering doesn't mm-hmm. occur in California politics?
Well, money laundering is already a crime in California, and we can enforce on any money laundering activity. But the
penalty for that is, I think you had said earlier, I'd heard, three times the amount of the donation.
Right.
In this $11 million donation, it's a $33 million fine.
That's correct. It would be a $33 million fine if we go after these groups civilly.
If you can find them.
If we can find them, and obviously if they're able to pay, if they have any money to pay. But we will certainly seek that kind of a penalty if the facts disclose that they knew.
And I interrupted you, and you were saying that what you're going to do with the California legislature this
right.
year. What will you be asking them, or would you like to see them do in terms of disclosure?
We're asking for much more regulation of independent expenditure committees so that they must disclose all this information if they have made contributions that meet a certain threshold. And we're also asking for the ability to enforce before elections much more quickly.
How can you do that, though, if they're dumping money in, you know, 2 or 3 days or a week before an election?
Right. Well, if we have independent authority clearly to force these committees to give us this information, mm-hmm. it would go a long way to solving the problem, because then they would be subject to greater penalties if they failed to do so.
Well, I want to thank Ann Ravel, chair
thank
of the
you.
California Fair Political Praxis Commission, for joining us. We're now joined by two veteran observers of the state politics, John Myers, political editor for News 10 in Sacramento, and Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Welcome back to the Mattie Report.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, Dan, we've been discussing this secret $11 million campaign contribution that was unsuccessful in that it Prop 30 did pass and Prop 32 didn't. Do you think that that contribution actually backfired?
It probably did in the long run. Although there's two ways to look at it, that the opponents of 30 and the proponents of 32 really didn't have much money to spend. So by getting the $11 million, they were able to do some things that they might not have otherwise done. But it probably also had a negative effect. It backfired. Certainly Jerry Brown jumped on it and made a big thing about this secret cabal of somebody from Arizona who's trying to buy California, and I mean, you know, sort of political hyperbole. In the end, did Proposition 30 pass and 32 fail because of it in the backlash, or either way? Probably didn't affect the outcome.
But it certainly, I think, became a distraction for the people who wanted 30 to fail and 32 to pass.
You always want a target to aim at, and that seemed to give them a target to aim at.
Yeah.
John, let me ask you, you think there's going to be a push, because of this, a push for increased disclosure of campaign funding?
I do. I mean, I think it raised a lot of questions. I mean, you know, keep in mind that, you know, every state has its own campaign finance rules. Mm-hmm. The debate here was whether or not this outside group had to be subject to California disclosure rules, which were more strict than some other places. Having said that, I think it did, it did point out some holes, loopholes, you might call them, in that law. I've already heard talk. I think you're going to see it in the legislature. I think you're going to see a pushback. It's the argument from Democrats about Citizens United, about the Supreme Court ruling, about that just because you can spend money doesn't mean you can spend money in secret. And so I think you're going to see that. Of course, you have to go to the ballot. You have to get the voters of California to do that. That's a ballot measure the legislature would have to put on the ballot. But I think you'll see it.
Okay. Dan, what about these propositions? Like 5 out of the 11, almost half, were supported by one very wealthy donor. Has that basically turned the populist idea of an initiative kind of on its head?
Yeah, to a certain extent it has. It's what was envisioned as a kind of a populist movement, obviously 100 years ago, has morphed into something that, because of the size of the state, basically, You can't do it that way. You have to do it with money, and you have to have somebody put up the money, whether it's a wealthy organization, in the case of, say, Jerry Brown's Proposition 30, it was the unions basically put up the money, or in the case of a wealthy individual putting up the money, like Charles Munger or something like that.
The Munger
or
family.
Or Munger family, yes, yeah. Molly Munger. I mean, it takes a lot of money. It takes maybe $3 million to qualify a measure for the ballot, and then if it's a serious measure and you're really serious about it, you can look at $10, $15, $20, $30 million more to spend it, and that money doesn't just come in drips and drabs. And because it's a very short time frame and you got to have the money in hand to do it, and so it's the way it is. And if you want a ballot measure on the ballot these days, you've got to basically put up a lot of money.
Well, that goes to the question of, do you think the legislature is going to attempt to limit the use of initiatives?
I think they're going to discuss it. I mean, again, keep in mind, the only things the legislature can do is put measures on the ballot to amend the state constitution and let the voters have a whack at that. I mean, I think you're hearing it already. You're hearing discussions about could we have an initiative process where the initiative has a sunset clause in it, where it expires after a certain amount of time, where the legislature can go back and tinker in it, which, of course, is going to raise the ire of a lot of people of saying, you know, our whole goal is to work around mm-hmm. what they would think would be an intractable set of lawmakers at the state capitol. But, you know, you look at the polling, Californians continue to say they like the initiative process, they'd like some modifications, but what those modifications are, I think that's the tough part.
Okay. There's another aspect to that is that you have to be careful that if the modifications aren't some sort of a thing to gain some party advantage. The measures the Democrats have put forth in the past have basically had the effect of crippling conservative ballot measures, but not crippling liberal ballot measures. And so you have to put that in the context of the party control of the legislature. They're not going to do it out of the goodness of their hearts. They're going to do it because they see some advantage for their party.
Could you see some nonpartisan group like the Hoover Commission, Little Hoover Commission, or the LAO or the PPIC, or some group come forward with a proposal?
Yeah, you could see them. They've made proposals for years. This has been kicked around in the Capitol for 20 or 30 years. But ultimately, the legislature would have to pass something, or somebody would have to go to the ballot with a ballot measure that would cost lots of money. So it doesn't happen just because PPIC or somebody pops up in the air. Somebody has to take some affirmative action. I don't think the Democrats will do anything that inhibits their allies from putting measures on the ballot. They will try to inhibit their opponents, like, for example, banning paid signature gathering, which leaves the unions able to put measures on the ballot, but not people on the right wing.
We've only got about a minute left in the segment. I want to ask you about the unintended consequences of election reform. Is that one of the reasons? Is the increased money in politics the result of more competitive races because of redistricting the top two?
I think it's everything. I think you could talk about electoral changes in candidate races. You can talk about the cost of television. You can cost the cost of a large state. I mean, I think it's everything. I mean, we are a nation state in California. I don't think anybody should be surprised that we spend more money than anybody else.
And there's one thing you always have to remember about the money that's spent in politics, whether it's campaign money, it's money for ballot measures, it's candidates, or even lobbying expenses for that matter. It's a lot of money. It's maybe $500 million every couple of years in California, which sounds like a lot of money, and it is, at least to me, not to you, Mark, but it's a lot of money to me. But you remember the stakes in this thing. The legislature, the governor, the other elected officials and their appointees control, I tried to figure it out, something in excess of $500 billion a year in spending directly, like things like insurance premiums and utility rates and taxes and budgets and federal funds. So the stakes of that are immense, and they are on the order of maybe 1,000 to 1 of the money that's spent in politics.
Well, that might explain it. Well, I want to thank Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, John Myers, political editor for Sacramento News 10, Kevin Yamamura, political reporter for the Sacramento Bee, and Ann Revell, chair of the California Fair Political Praxis Commission, for joining us.
Up next, what influence is money having on Valley politics and elections? And is the political money flooding in or out of the San Joaquin Valley? We'll talk to Mike Valines, former Assembly Minority Leader, Juana Rambula, formerly of the Fresno School Board, the Fresno Board of Supervisors, and a member of the State Assembly, and John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee. That conversation in a moment.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. Is there a cost to free speech? We're joined by two former Valley legislators from both sides of the aisle, as well as a veteran political reporter, to discuss the issue of money in politics. They are Mike Valines, former minority leader in the Assembly for the Republicans, and Juana Rambula, formerly on the Fresno School Board, the Fresno County Board of Supervisors,
and a member of the state assembly, first as a Democrat, then as an independent. We're also joined by John Ellis, political reporter from the Fresno Bee. Well, welcome to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
Great to be here.
A quick editor's note. Both Mike and Juan are members of the nonpartisan Matty Institute's board of directors. Well, there's been a lot of talk about this last-minute $11 million secret contribution that came in to attempt to defeat the governor's Prop 30 as well as Prop 32, the union-targeted paycheck protection measures. Both lost. So, Juan, are we making much ado about nothing? Could money be less important than some people think?
I think money is very important in politics. It seems to me that money doesn't necessarily guarantee a victory. I mean, look at Meg Whitman, look at Mitt Romney. But if you don't have resources, then it's very likely that you're not going to be successful. So money won't determine the outcome, but if you don't have the resources, you're not going to be able to run an effective campaign.
Mike, what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, Juan, good to talk to you, buddy.
Likewise.
I think Juan's answer is correct. I think money is very, very important in politics. That's why you see people working so hard to raise it. The Sacramento Bee article today talked about, you know, the top committee chairs appointed are all the top fundraisers in their parties. So it's a part of it. But money doesn't guarantee an election, I don't think. I think the strong word that's important, though, is accountability. You know, you need to know where the money comes from, and people should be able to publicly make a decision on what that is. But you can see time and time again, and there's great examples of people who have had a lot of money or very little money and have been successful, or not based on what they said they were going to run on and who they are.
You know, I'm just curious, Mike, have you ever had a situation when you were in office or running for office where you were hit with a last-minute attack ad or a last-minute donation came in to your opponent?
I was hit with last-minute attack ads, and they were funded from a place that nobody could figure out in my first race. It didn't happen after that. And even then, with it listed as a public entity where the money came from, nobody could find out really who that group was or where it came from. But it didn't have an effect on the election. And, in fact, I think oftentimes those things backfire. For example, the $11 million donation you mentioned, I think that went out. I think that hurt things more than anything else. So it really, it's an interesting process to watch, and I think oftentimes it's not used properly, and people get mad about it.
You know, John, this $11 million that came in at the last minute, they tried to figure out where it came from. They never really did. It appears as those people who gave the money were kind of using a rope-a-dope strategy, and that delay basically worked. So in light of Citizens United, is it becoming more difficult for the media to report on these last-minute infusions of cash?
Well, I mean, it's always been hard. Even before this, I think, under Citizens United, it's very hard. I mean, as it turned out, we did find out who the donors were in this case. They were two other groups with anonymous donors in themselves. So
they were two Arizona groups. That got traced back to a Virginia group, but we never know the specific individuals.
And I think ultimately that it became a shell game, and I think that, you know, delaying tactics. I think if we had months and months, I don't know that we ever would have been able to untie almost like a Gordian knot of sorts because, you know, I just think these groups, you know, since Citizens United, they have the advantage, and I think they've really set up to find a way around the rules. I mean, they play fast and loose with them. They walk up to the edge. Maybe they even toe over them. Obviously, I think there's a debate whether they violated California's campaign disclosure laws, but certainly they probably were within their rights on a federal level. And I think whether that would have ever been decided, obviously, as you pointed out, you know, there was some very emergency type of hearings from the California Supreme Court and some last minute things and we never got to the bottom of it. But I don't know that we ever would have got to the bottom of it because it's just not easy. They have the upper hands in Citizens United.
So, Juan, you know, some people want to see increased disclosure requirements. Others counter and say this is going to be an invasion of the donor's right to privacy, that the donor on a losing campaign could face retaliation by those who end up winning. Where do you come down on this issue of disclosure, this right to know versus protection from retaliation and this right to privacy?
I think California voters deserve to know who's funding campaigns. That's an important piece of information to help us decide how we're going to vote on propositions or for or against candidates. And I think people who complain about this are trying to have it both ways. It seems to me that if you can't stand the heat, you don't go into the kitchen or you get out of the kitchen. When you jump into the political process, I think you waive some of your privacy rights. And, you know, the Citizens United didn't say that donors can remain confidential. It simply said there's no limits on what people can contribute and spend on campaigns. So I think that donors who complain about it are being hypocritical. I think when they intervene in politics, they know what they're getting into. And we as voters deserve to know who's trying to influence the process.
Well, you know, in the Citizens United decision, the court actually said one of the protections is disclosure. So, Mike, where are you on this issue of disclosure versus the right to privacy on political donations?
I'm in what Juan just said, we're in agreement. I'm for more disclosure. I mean, I'm actually for full disclosure and no limits. I think people should be allowed to give whatever they want. I think that the public should be able to see whoever is giving. And I think a candidate, whoever he or she is, should be willing to manage that and say, am I willing to accept that or not as a part of my campaign? So full disclosure and no limits, I think, is the way to go, because everything else seems to be, you know, playing in the margins, or what Juan said, where people are trying to have it both ways. And I just don't think that's appropriate. And, you know, in terms of retaliation, I mean, you know, everything always changes in politics. I don't know that retaliation is really true, but if that is the issue, then like Juan said, then don't be involved in politics. Now, that may hurt one party more than the other party in a certain year, but on the very next year, it could be the difference. So I just think full disclosure is better. People have a right to know, and I still stipulate, when people give money and you don't know where it's coming from, it makes voters mad and it works against that candidate as a general rule.
Well, what about the practical problem of people dumping in cash at the last minute? How are you ever going to know, you know, where that money came from? You simply don't have the time to track that down.
Well, I mean, first, it can't be cash, but I know what you mean, putting in last minute donations. I think that, you know, that's just part of the process. Somebody wants to put it at the very last minute, it's public. It should be online. You should be able to see it. And even after the election, you can see it. That could be, you know, used against somebody or to help somebody in the next cycle, saying, hey, this money came at the very last second. But the reality is the money doesn't come in at the last minute. Money that really tries to manipulate elections comes in four to 6 weeks out, maybe three at the latest, where they really try to come in and influence an election with heavy negative advertising, you know, or other gimmicks. But that's typically what they do to influence election. Last minute spending is really not true. That's not really how it works. They're really trying to influence the election before, and it's just inappropriate at any time, but especially then.
But this last campaign, the $11 million, which was the biggest anonymous donation that's ever happened in California politics, occurred in the last couple of weeks of the campaign.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of instructive points. Number one, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. I do not believe that benefited the campaign one bit, right? It actually worked completely against them, and like a laser beam focus or a white hot light put a focus on that and manipulation of elections and worked against them. And number two, if they were trying to manipulate the election, maybe they had polling that thought it would help, but it came in too late to make a difference. I think those two things added up to them getting beat.
Well, you know, John, let me ask you, you're a reporter, you're covering this beat. Is it difficult to track money at the city or county level as opposed to the state or federal level?
Well, I don't think federal is very easy. State is, let me put it this way, none of them are really easy. I think the state probably, it's once again, it's unwinding, you know, can be a lot of shells. Some of these groups that are, you know, they collect money, they become like third party, they do independent expenditures. You have to know where to look. You have to peel back into like an onion to get to the bottom of it. This, in the city and the county, there are rules. The FPPC has set up rules for disclosure. Certainly after the last, the final reporting period, I think it's within a few weeks of the election. Mm-hmm. As you get closer to that, then there's a 24-hour reporting notice. But you have to go see, for instance, in the county, you have to go down there because they get them in there, and then the county clerk will make them available immediately. But then, you know, that involves you having to go down to the county elections office, look through them. Eventually, they will redact certain information, scan them, put them online. But that is a delayed process. So, you know, to be on top of it, you would really need to be down at the county elections office almost constantly in the closing weeks of the election. And that's, you know, realistically, it's very hard, given our staffing levels, you know, for me to be down there all the time looking at who's giving money, especially considering, you know, I'm doing city, county, state. It's just time consuming and not friendly to the reporters.
Well, what about, you know, in addition, you always see in the newspaper how much candidates or initiatives are getting in terms of donations. But what about publishing who the major donors are?
And we do that sometimes. I always look at it, you know, I found it interesting, you know, if it's Bob Smith Camp, let's see, somebody, a name that you would know in town, Ed Cashin, just I think names that are very well known to Fresno people. I'll put their name in the paper. I always look, or if it's somebody from out of the area who, you know, is wealthy, a wealthy donor from Los Angeles or San Francisco, you know, if I know their name, if I think people are going to know their name and they're putting money into a local race, I'll certainly would publicize that. And I think it's much easier for me, once again, on the state level to track down those donors. It's not so easy on the city and the county. But there was, when Henry T. Prey ran for mayor against Ashley Swearingen, there was a large donation from, well, they ran some money from this Hollywood, West Hollywood-based PAC, ran some money against for Henry T., but also for some other candidates. And there was a lot of consternation that we wrote about that. But I thought it was interesting that they had this PAC that was almost, a lot of it was funded. Some of it was Fresno money. Some of it was out-of-state money. They never broke down, though, how much money was spent on Henry T.'s race.
Well, let's talk about, Mike, let's talk about where some big money was spent this year, and that was on the initiatives. $375 million were spent on the 11 initiatives on the ballot. The current Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg, is talking about reforming the state's initiative process. So the question is, does it need reform? And if so, how?
Well, I believe it needs reform, but I don't know the answer. So, you know, in typical fashion, let me describe the problem. And then I think it's going to take some smart men and women willing to sit down and really be thoughtful in the legislature and work with citizens almost like a commission to work through this. Because let me start at the end. You can't take it away, the initiative process, from people. California is unique in it. It has a culture in the state, and it's important. However, I've said this many a time, I believe the system has been completely taken over and abused. What it really is now is a consultant's funding dream. You have people that get paid to get signatures, people that get paid to write the ballot statement in a way that confuses people but is legal. You have lawyers who are paid to be on this 24/7. You have people that are paid to, you know, go out and organize all the signature gathering. You have people paid to work on the fundraising. You have people paid to work on the political It is a complete cottage industry that is made for people to make money, and I don't think the majority of those people even care, or I'm curious sometimes if they even know what initiative they're working on outside of making money. When you have 17, 18, 19, 20 plus initiatives on the ballot, that's an abuse of the system. It's meant to give the people a voice who didn't have one in the times when we need reform in California. So I don't have the perfect answer, but I do believe there's a time to make a change. We just can't keep having it. It's not that expensive and hard of a threshold to put something on the ballot and just, you know, make money doing it. And that's not what people want, and that's not what the system was created for. So we really do need to sort of sit back thoughtfully and find out, how do we maintain the people's voice, the ability to go and you know, have an initiative process, but not to have it abused the way it's been.
Well, Juan, let me ask you, does the initiative process really become kind of the fourth branch of government and is really displaced in some ways the legislature?
Well, you know, let's keep in mind, Mark, the initiative and referendum process was begun in California as a correction to what the abuses that were going on back then. Essentially, railroads and other monopolies owned the legislature. It was called the best legislature money could buy. So initiatives and referendums were a way for the citizenry to get around the legislature when it wasn't doing the people's business. I think now there are plenty of abuses in the initiative process itself, so we need to make some corrections there. I don't think it's replacing the legislature, but in many ways, the legislature, when it doesn't act, it creates pressure, and people feel if they can't get a solution within the process, they have to go around the legislative process and go straight to the initiative process. Both of them, I think, have plenty of flaws at this point. They were designed for a good purpose, but times have changed.
Okay. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about the political dollars in the Valley, where it's coming from and where it's going. And does all this money buy political clout for the Valley in Sacramento and Washington? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about money in politics with two former state assembly members, Mike Valines, Republican, and Juan Arambula, Democrat turned independent, and John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee. Well, John, there are some that complain that the Valley is kind of treated like an ATM by those who serve in Sacramento and Washington, and that we get little return for our investment. Is that true? Does Valley money result in influence in Sacramento, Washington, or not?
Well, first of all, I think that we are most definitely an ATM. When I said it back in 2000, all the Republicans got mad at me because George Bush, who was running for president at the time, actually did spend some money in California. Not a ton, but he spent some. Now when I say it, I don't get a peep out of anybody because everybody pretty much acknowledges it. And, you know, not only to the presidential candidates, but if you've seen in this last election cycle, Danny Tarkanian, who's running in Nevada for Congress, came here for money. You had Mitch McConnell come through, Dan Lundgren, John Garamendi, Democrat, although, you know, Republicans have much more money than Democrats. But does it matter? I have a hard time.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, some would argue that the unions have a lot of money, too. So
they do, but I don't. But, you know, from locally, you know, if you see it, a lot of that money comes from, say, the Carpenters Union or whatever. If you look up, and that's based out of Sacramento. Do they have Fresno members? Yes, they do. But I still think if you look at the local donor lists, individuals, you know, there's more Republican money being given here than Democratic money. You know, Obama never came here for a fundraiser while you had both Romney and, Paul Ryan come here for a thing. But doesn't matter. I have a hard time seeing it. You know, there was talk of 99 getting widened, and it is slowly. Ag constantly complaining that they're, we need more water, they need some changes in legislation.
Let me ask you this. Return on investment. Okay, make it simple in economic terms. You don't see it?
I don't see it.
Well, Mike, let me ask you a question. You know, Republicans are now down to less than a third in both houses of the legislature. And there's a concern that some traditional Republican donors like the Chamber of Commerce might start funding moderate Democratic candidates in hopes of having some influence. So the question is, could this be a self-fulfilling downward spiral for California Republicans?
I don't think so. Again, I think that politics and government, you know, change all the time. And so things will always change that we don't anticipate. But specifically, corporations, the business community in general has been investing in quote-unquote moderate Democrats for a long time and will continue to, even more now. And I argue that they may be looking for, you know, sort of moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats to create a block of an ability to block or move legislation. So I think that you're not seeing the unwinding of the Republican Party. I think you're going to see, you know, some thoughtful consideration of where the party needs to go, and that needs to happen. But the business community is invested in moderate legislators and moderate Democrats and will continue to because that's what they're looking for is moderation and, you know, reliability and long-term planning.
Yeah, I'm curious. Let's get practical here. I'm wondering, how much time did you spend, Mike, on fundraising when you were in office?
Inordinate. A lot. I mean, I raised a lot of money and was somebody who gave it to the team, the caucus that was always expected of you. And so you did that to try to, you know, have political war chest for everybody. And then as leader, Dave Cogdill and I, when we went out in a 2-year cycle, raised $12.5 million, which paled in comparison to our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, but was at the time a record. It is an inordinate amount of time you spend raising money, and it takes you away from the good work that you need to be doing, and that's just the truth.
Juan, what was your experience?
I spent the least amount of time possible raising money. I enjoyed fundraising about the same as I enjoyed getting a root canal.
But you did have to do it.
Yes, you do. It's a necessary evil. If you want to get involved in politics and if you want to be effective, you have to have access to resources.
Well, let me kind of switch topics here a little bit. It does tie into money and politics, and that is, John, the situation of political reforms, the election reforms that occurred, top two primary redistricting. It impacted some Valley races significantly, most notably the Senate race between Kathleen Galgiani and Bill Berryhill. Is this one of the unintended consequences of election reform, that it now costs a lot more to run for office?
Well, I think it depends on which races you're talking about. You know, I think, you know, some of the top two primary, for instance, you're going to still have some races that are going to have a traditional. It's going to be a Democrat versus Republican in the general election, and it's going to be a district that clearly tilts one way or the other, and it's probably going to be like it was in the old days. But then, you know, you gave that example, Berryhill, Galgiani. I think of the 5th Assembly District, which was Madera County Supervisor Frank Bigelow's race, and you know, you had Rico Aller, and you had a lot of people that really didn't like Rico Aller, and a lot of Republicans didn't even, because he was so ardently, stridently conservative and just unapologetic about it. Well, you had a ton of money in the first and then the primary, and then when just to get that to get Bigelow into the top two, and then they both advanced, two Republicans advanced to the general. Now, in the old days, Bigelow would have been out. Aller would have gone on to run in the general, and it would have been a no-brainer. He would have won. Well, then you had additional money that had to be funded. And believe me, hundreds of thousands of dollars went into Bigelow. He actually ended up winning. I think there's an example maybe where money did make a difference. A lot of third-party money, a lot of IE money.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Are you seeing more outside money in Valley elections?
Well, I was this time. That race is a perfect example. I mean, this is one of those examples where you just had a ton of money from all different parts of the state. You had a lot of these big money organizations pouring hundreds of thousands of dollars in. I mean, these IEs on behalf of Bigelow against Aller, both ways. They ran a lot of radio ads. They ran a lot of mailers that went into people's homes. And I think that ended up making the difference because Aller did finish first in the primary. Bigelow bested him then when it became a one-on-one contest in the general. And I think money, that's one example, I think, where you did see money make a difference in a race.
You know, Juan, you know, the media often equates money raised with viability of a candidate right. or an initiative. But what about the ground game? Isn't that as or maybe even more important?
Well, I think you need both, Mark. But from the outside, in order to get a quick assessment of a candidate's viability, it is helpful to know how successful they've been at raising money. You know, it's hard to measure a ground game. It's hard to measure enthusiasm by your volunteers. But it's easy to know what's the bottom line on your bank account.
It's a nice objective measure.
It's half of the equation. If you don't have it, then the ground game by itself will be very difficult. So if you have the resources and you have a good ground game, then you have a much better chance of getting elected. But the money is what other people will notice, and money generates money. So if they see that someone is able to get traction locally, then people at the statewide level are more likely to give. You know, so they evaluate based on money. There's no doubt about that. But money alone is not going to do it.
Mike, what are your thoughts on this? Is it the ground game? Is it money? Is it both?
It's both. I think it weighs more. If you're doing a 50-50 type of comparison, I would make it a 60-40, where money matters because, as Juan said, and John, you know, you've written about where candidates that seem to have more money in the bank just typically become written about more. Those men and women are talked about more, and people want to put money because they're raising money. They think, oh, they're going to win, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The volunteers you must have, though. Many people look past that. There are examples of races where they just didn't get it done because they thought they might win, for example, and then they just didn't have a volunteer base. And I would just say that one of the things Republicans need to sort of retrench and look at is the success of the Democrat Party and the success of unions to coordinate and, frankly, have a much broader and vigorous volunteer base that goes out. I mean, making phone calls, knocking on doors, working with candidates.
Well, that's been a traditional strength of unions from the get-go.
And it's stronger. And part of it was because of Prop 32 and other things. But that is a reality that Republicans have to find out. How do they get that same vigor, that same involvement? Because it was the difference in some elections, and it was very effective.
You know, we've only got about a minute left in the program, but I wanted to ask you, you've all been around the block, and you've seen the influence of politics and money firsthand. So Juan, I'll start with you. What would you suggest to make the political process better?
Full disclosure. Everybody should have to disclose that they're contributing and how much, so that we as voters can take that into account. And I think there needs to be some controls, additional controls on these super PACs.
Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, full disclosure and unlimited, and then you can get rid of the PACs because then you know where everything is coming from, and it should be online.
Yes.
Everything should be online so you can see where it's coming from.
Well, John, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, Mike took those words right out of my mouth. Online, ease of access, not only for journalists, but for the general public. You don't have to go down to the elections office or go hunting around websites here, there, and everywhere to find this information. It should be easy to find, and I say full disclosure as much as possible.
Well, I want to thank our guests, former State Assembly members Mike Valliens and Juan Arambula, as well as John Ellis, the political reporter for the Fresno Bee, for joining us. If you want to stay up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, just by logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.